have 3 hours. They've got to go through all four game quads. 3 hours or less, and they're going to need every second, because you know who's on their tail? Who? And you know what happens then? What? Right, without further ado, it's time to start running!
Welcome to this review of The Running Man, part of the Percolated Media Stephen King Retrospective Series.
I'm going to give the audience what I think they want.
Join Garrett.
That boy's one mean motherfucker.
Matt.
You look pissed, Ben.
And Adam.
You can't believe this shit.
As they review this adaptation of King's apocalyptic novel.
Guess they want us to stay.
And keep coming back, podcast listeners, as a Three Men in a Retrospective podcast will continue going through the popular novelist's cinematic adaptations in publication order.
Come on, get me out of here, you guys!
This is not a rerun.
What a colossal fight!
The Percolated Media review of The Running Man begins now!
It's showtime!
The Running Man, released November 13th, 1987. Budget was $27 million. Box office, $38.1 million. And this is directed, in the end, by Paul Michael Glaser, Starsky himself. Boys, we have spent over a month discussing King properties. We discussed The Stand. We discussed The Dead Zone. We discussed Firestarter. We discussed Cujo. Now we are getting to something that, well, doesn't even have Stephen King's name attached. Why? Well, we'll get into that here in a bit. First, let me introduce my co-host, number one, my number one hunter, my best friend for over 30 years, Mr. Adam Bunch. Adam, how are you, sir?
Nice to be here. Audience, let's hear it for you. Way to go. Our host, everybody.
And my number two, Mr. Matthew Goudreau. Matthew, how are you, sir?
Am I just plain zero then?
Oh my God, so many puns.
They should have called this The Punning Man.
Boys, I cannot believe it. We have been podcasting together for about, let's see, we did Before Sunrise was the first set of shows we did as a threesome. Now we are actually taking on an Arnold property for the very first time, an Arnold Schwarzenegger film. And what a movie we have here. Matt, can you believe it's taken this long to get to Arnold?
No, and if I had really thought about it, I would have protested further, but it's all about placement and trying to find the right avenue to do it. Look, I was ready to tap out of the Stephen King retro, and I'm sure Adam's going to feel the same when you get to him, but you had me at Schwarzenegger. I mean, if there's one way you're going to get me to continue, at least for this chunk, it was through that Austrian superstar.
Well, we're ending with this one. And Adam, I'm sure you and I, we've probably had many, many Arnold discussions over the years. I think we've probably seen a few of his films in the theaters together. Here we are. We're discussing Arnold. Are you excited?
I'm excited. It's kind of crazy that this is the first one that it is. Not Predator. No. You know,
not Terminator.
Not Terminator. Not Conan. No. Not even Kindergarten Cop. No. We're starting with not even a King on title. So I bet nowadays they'd probably re-release this book with his name on it. But when I do think of Arnold movies, I do think of this one here, The Running Man. This is one of those that I guess you have to use classic with Arnold with a little bit of brevity, a little bit of winking. But I do think of Arnold classic and Running Man kind of in the same paragraph when you discuss them.
All right. So how did Arnold get in this? Well, we got to go way back, boys. We got to go back to, how did the book come to be, specifically The Running Man, specifically Stephen King's The Running Man? Back in late 70s, King had put out three books, and we know him in the last 20 years or so. We know that the man is prolific. He puts out a ton of books, a lot of times more than one a year. But back in the 70s, it was looked at as overexposure if an author put out more than one book a year. He wanted to follow Carrie up with this one, and his publisher was like, you know what? No, you already have a book out. We're not going to saturate the market. So after a few years, he went to the other publisher he was at, Signet, and he got them to agree to release these books under the Richard Bachman alias. Now, that is a story that has been out there for many years. It has kind of changed. King himself has said in recent years that he was the one who decided to kind of take a test to see if it was actually his name that was selling the books or if it was actually the writing itself. which is why he came up with Richard Bachman, Richard being the first name of author by the name of Donald E. Westlake, a character alias of his, who we'll be talking about when we get to the Dark Half. And Bachman, well, he happened to be listening to the radio, and Bachman Turner Overdrive was on the radio, so he decided to use that as the last name. So we have Richard Bachman. Now, Matt, you've heard that story, right?
No, I know next to nothing about the whole Richard Bachman origins outside of when the ruse was revealed.
Yeah, I'll get to that. The first book he released under Richard Bachman was a book called Rage. And this was a book he had written probably late high school, maybe college. And it is about a kid who goes to school, shoots it up, and holds the classroom hostage. And it's kind of a back and forth between him and the negotiator on the outside. And some of the classmates of his actually end up eventually getting on his side. It's a bizarre read. It's not a very good read. And then in 1997, after a few school shootings had happened, that book had been found in a few of the teenagers' backpacks and lockers. And King decided, you know what? I'm pulling it from the shelves. That was the first book. And then he did one called Road Work, which is about a guy who is very angry that there's a freeway being built around him and he's being evicted. So he comes up with a way of getting revenge on the city. And he did one called The Long Walk, which we're going to get a adaptation of that here pretty soon, actually, which is kind of a prelude to this one where we have kids who are walking. And if they walk below 5 miles an hour, they get shot. Kind of like a sport that people pay to see and go to. And then he came out with this one. In 1984, he came out with a book that we're going to be discussing here pretty soon called Thinner. And it was in that time where somebody who worked at a library, he, for some reason, noticed similarities between King and Richard Bachman's writing. And he went to the Library of Congress. He was working in Washington, D.C., and was able to prove that, yes, it was Stephen King, because under the copyright, you have to have your real name in there. And so he was outed in 1984. Still released a few books under the name Richard Bachman, but that is pretty much the story of Bachman. And, you know, it's funny. Out of the time that King's works have been adapted, there's only been two that have been adapted. One twice. We have this, and we have Thinner. And we're going to have The Long Walk at the end of this year. So, Adam, were you aware of any of that?
The only thing I was aware of it was the pen name and that it was outed. But the whole reason, the why, and of course, even that is going to be, you know, even that they can't agree on. But other than that, no. I really wasn't aware. I have opinions on a lot of musicians and writers using pen names to do it, so I'm always kind of ambivalent to that. I have opinions. I've given it a whatever. I've kept my negatives to myself.
Well, when it comes to Richard Bachman, it's weird, because he released a volume of four stories, Rage, Road Work, The Long Walk, and this, called The Bachman Book, which is a book I used to carry around a lot. Adam probably remembers the red cover that had the skulls on it that I used to walk around with. Mm-hmm. Those stories are funny, because they're very mean-spirited. There's not much story arcs in them. And King himself says in the intro to the Bachman Book's volume, he says that, look, I wrote a lot of these, Running Man included, as a very angry young man. So that Rage, I guess you can say, was coming out in those particular stories. So that's the story of Richard Bachman. Now, how did The Running Man get adapted? Well, a producer by the name of George Linder, Austrian producer, which is very telling given who the star of this movie is. He was at an airport and saw there was a book by Richard Bachman called The Running Man, picked it up, read it, really enjoyed it. And he decided that he was going to sell his company. He had a wheelchair company at the time. He was going to sell all stock in that to get the rights to The Running Man. And when he went to get the rights, the publisher told him it would be $100,000. And the producer was like, why is this so goddamn expensive to get the rights to this? And the publisher was the one who had to say, well, yeah, it actually is a Stephen King property. And so he got help. And Matt, we have discussed another producer on this, a guy by the name of Rob Cohen. He was on this. And this was years before he did the first Fast and Furious film. He helped fund this. And then it came time to get a director. And they went through a few. The first one, George P. Cosmatos. He had just done Rambo First Blood Part 2, and they thought, you know what, this guy could probably handle this. You know, he just worked with Stallone. He could do this Schwarzenegger film. He was on for a few weeks, and he wanted to have it take place at a mall. And his ideas were pretty discarded because it was deemed too expensive. They then got some foreign guy who did some foreign films, and nobody's ever heard of the films that this guy has done, so I'm not going to really discuss him. But the one I really want to discuss is the one that came up next. It was a guy who actually did shoot some footage that is in the film, a guy by the name of Andrew Davis. People know Andrew Davis. He has done a few Seagal films. He did...
He did the best Seagal movie, let's be honest.
He did, yeah. He did Above the Law.
I would say Under Siege is by far, I think, his best movie. And he also did The Fugitive, which showed he could do a... I don't want to call it elevated... type of movie, but it's very similar. Like it's high art action, if you want to call it that.
I would make a run for Hard to Kill as somebody who has just rewatched a lot of Seagal's films in the last week or so, but that's for another day, maybe. The Fugitive would come 6 years later, but he was on this, but there's a prison sequence here, and for some reason, Davis really concentrated on that. It was supposed to go only 3 days. That part of the shoot was going 7 days, and he was going way over budget, so they canned him pretty quick. And at this point, Cohen, he was watching Miami Vice at the time, and there was an episode directed by Starsky himself, Paul Michael Glazer, who was brought on. Paul Michael Glazer would go on. Adam, you remember the other film he did, right?
Remind me.
Well, the one he did before The Running Man, Band of the Hand, which is basically three movies in one, because it starts off as like kind of a Breakfast Club type of what you would see like the Brat Pack do. It's got prison elements, and then it turns into like a siege movie at the end.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Which actually kind of fits this movie.
Yes. What also fits it is what he did after this, because he did a little movie called The Cutting Edge.
Which, okay. Yeah. Oh, shit, but that movie's I like that movie a lot, but B, that movie's got more montages than all the Rocky movies combined.
It was one of my sister's favorites. I used to have to watch it constantly, and I'll admit I kind of enjoyed it as well. Then he did one that, well, Kevin Bacon was going through a funny career in the 90s, and he did one called The Air Up There back in 1994, which, if you read reviews, it's basically called The Racism Up There, because there's so much racism in that movie if you watch it. But I have a guilty pleasure for that one as well. And then he did The Shack starring Kazam in 1996. That was his last film as a director. Not a real decorated career, but at this point they had gone through so many directors, so many iterations, that they had to get this budget under control. If anything, you bring a TV director on, that can happen.
Oh, absolutely. Let's remember, I consider this kind of in the prime Schwarzenegger. I think 87 to like 94 is kind of his peak. So his salary was on the rise. There was never a time you were going to make this and try to keep it manageable, because I mean, $27 million, that's a lot for this movie. Look at this compared to how much The Terminator was made for a few years prior.
That was like 8 or 9, wasn't it?
No, it was less than that.
Oh, wow.
I don't think $1 million, that's too low, but $6 million.
Now, Adam, how do you feel about this? I mean, you bring your TV director on to get this under budget, right?
Yeah, and I think that's what you do to get it on schedule and on budget. Ask Marvel, because that's how they got through their entire phase 2 and 3 of what they did. It's kind of needed. Those people are used to pushing stuff out at a very reasonable, albeit quick, kind of clip. You know, they're shooters. When you get an hour-long episode and you got 8 to 12 days to shoot it, they know what they're doing. And absolutely, that's who you get.
The record, they're called stalkers, not shooters.
And you also get, Matt, you mentioned this was the height of Arnold's powers, right? This is when he was really getting in his prime, because Predator was out this year. He had some power, and they wanted to please him, so they brought in the screenwriter by the name of Stephen E. D'Souza. Now, this guy had just done Commando for Arnold, so they knew he was comfortable with him. I have just listened to an interview with him, and he said he was the one who did a lot of the ADR for Arnold at this time. With a lot of these one-liners that we're going to be discussing, he comes in, does a script that is, after he read the book, he decided there's no way I can adapt this. Because the way the book is situated is, and we didn't really discuss the book, it's a very skinny guy. He is described by King in that book as being pre-tubicular. He's so unathletic. The one they wanted, and Matt, you've heard this, the one they wanted before they went to Arnold, and I would have liked to have seen this actually back in 1987, was Christopher Reeve.
Yes, but it would have been this is very much the Total Recall situation, where originally, if both Total Recall and The Running Man focus on regular Joe Schmo type of guys, that turned into Arnold Schwarzenegger action movie projects. They're both science fiction. They both deal with kind of people on the run, so to speak. So very similar, but Christopher Reeve would have been a very different movie. This would have been, you say normal guy, I imagine he would have had to not be in Superman shape to convincingly pull that off.
Well, we discussed in Superman 4 that he wasn't in Superman shape, so this was right around that time.
I think that would have given him what he always wanted, which is to kind of have that everyman acting role that he was never able to get post Superman, other than here and there. I think it would have been a different kind of movie, and from what I understand, it would have been more faithful to the book. And I think that's what we're going to be getting when this movie gets remade. Much like Total Recall, I think they're trying to get to source material to try to appease both sides of it.
Yeah, we'll discuss that at the end of this, but there's definitely things to discuss when it comes to Edgar Wright's remake, which is coming out the end of this year. They then went to Arnold. Now, it's just D'Souza was here to pretty much adhere to Arnold's sensibilities, and if anything, Matt, I mean, this is quintessential Arnold sensibility, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at some of the people that are in this movie, not just the obvious other governor that's in this that also starred with Arnold in a movie in 1987.
Yep.
But, you know, he gets one of his lifting buddies who we'll talk about. But yeah, this is, I think, to Adam's point, this is part of Schwarzenegger's canon. Like, if you're looking for, like, most recognizable movies, I mean, part of it is just the costuming that he has to wear throughout this movie, the jumpsuit. People can kind of recognize this movie out of, if you show him a frame, but certainly this has all the hallmarks of what Arnold was doing at this time.
You know, we're going to say a lot of things about this movie, about this property, but one thing is, this thing was pretty prophetic, wasn't it? I mean, we're going to discuss so many things that were ahead of its time in this silly little action science fiction film.
You could put this in Demolition Man as a twofer and think that you're watching documentaries on the last fucking 10 years of this country, man. Oof, it is stunning how things that are old are new again, and it's like reading 1984. Just wait. Yep. Just wait.
Speaking of people who should be put in court, I know everyone talks about Battle Royale, but Hunger Games stole more from this than it did from that.
Well, you know, it stole more than Hunger Games was the American Gladiators. Because Stephen E. D'Souza said in that interview that the creator flat out told him, yeah, we came up with the idea of American Gladiators after watching your movie to the point where we took a scissor reel from the movie to sell the property, which worked, and they got American Gladiators on the air. Oh, man.
Watch that amazing documentary they did on Netflix, yeah. And they flat out say it in there, too, because they wanted a sizzle reel. They're like, well, we could do it cheaper, and they just took parts of this film.
Matt, you mentioned Jesse the Body Ventura, and you have to say that a big reason why this thing had to have been sold is, I mean, the three of us are big WWF fans. My God, WWF was on top of the world in the mid-80s. Matt, that has to be a reason, right?
Oh, God, we're going to talk about all the wrestling analogies we can make once you get into this movie. This might as well have been sponsored. I mean, if you swap out Richard Dawson for Vince McMahon,
yes,
there would not have been much of a, like, nobody would have batted an eyelash.
The only thing this thing is missing is Gorilla Monsoon narrating it for the audience at home.
Yeah, or Gene Okerlund interviewing the stalkers before they go into the before they go into the quadrants.
Man, so many things to discuss.
This would be awesome.
One more thing I wanted to mention about D'Souza. In that interview, he did say that Arnold was pretty, he didn't say upset, but he was disappointed that there wasn't more of the King book in the movie. He wanted to kind of expand what he could do in that movie. And if you read that book, there are so many things that character goes through. It's so different. In that book, Matt, have you read it?
No, I have not.
In the book, he has a wife and kid. His child has some kind of disease, and he needs medication. The wife is out turning tricks for money when she can. She's out hooking. And he goes on the show not because he's framed for murder like in this movie. He goes on the show because he needs the money to get this medication for his daughter. By the end, he gets told by Killian that, actually, we killed your wife and kid before you even got on the show as you were going through the trials to get on. So what does Richards do? Matt, you're aware of how this ends, right?
No, I don't.
Oh, my God. I am curious if Wright will do this. This is my biggest curiosity about this movie when it comes out. He takes a plane and he crashes it right into the skyscraper where this is being broadcast from. So, yes.
No. He better not.
I think he will. You know what? I think he will. I think there's a possibility that we will see, if not the crash, the near impact, and we'll cut to black.
I think he'll film it. I think there will be a cut where it's filmed, but I don't think it's Universal, right? I don't think there's any way they're putting that out.
Edgar Wright might do it. I think he has the balls to do it. We'll discuss more of that at the end here, but yeah, that's how that book ends.
If they do that in the remake, we will come on the show and say you were right. I'm with Adam. I don't think that's going to happen.
I can guarantee he's not going to take the woman that he hasn't had any form of chemistry with and kiss her on the screen to end things, but we'll discuss all of that. Let's get into the movie. The funny little title sequence of a whole bunch of digital guys running. We then get a Ridley Scott-esque opening scroll, which says that by 2017, the world economy has collapsed. Food, natural resources, and oil are in short supply. A police state divided into pre-military zones rules with an iron hand. Television is controlled by the state, and a sadistic game show called The Running Man has become the most popular program in history. All art, music, and communications are censored. No dissent is tolerated, and yet a small resistance movement has managed to survive underground.
Did Suzanne Collins write that? The only part that's missing is a rebellion that caused the police state to take effect.
When high-tech gladiators are not enough to suppress the people's yearning for freedom, more direct methods become necessary. Boy, by the way, the book does not take place in 2017. It takes place in 2025. True story.
Well, they got it right both ways.
Yeah.
No wonder Trump hates King so much. And vice versa.
Matt, yeah, right. Matt, you always hate these Ridley Scott-type scrolls. How do you feel about how this sets things up?
I do. It's just a cognitive bias I have against storytelling. But I will say I'm more lenient when they did it back in the day because, A, this movie is only 95 minutes. So you don't have a whole lot of time to do a full-fledged world build. But I look at this in the same way that the Mad Max movies do it. This movie is very much in line with a lot of the stuff you were getting in the 80s. I mean, this is Mad Max, you know, with the world on the brink of collapse. It's crazy this came out the same year as RoboCop, too, because this is satire as much as RoboCop is. But they only have so much to work with. But I also think this gives you the essentials, but the movie complements it by having stuff in the background for the first 30 minutes that add to it, so you're not getting everything strictly in text.
This movie has Paul Verhoeven written all over it. I know he was doing RoboCop at this time, but fuck, man. Probably should have waited.
You say Verhoeven. I had a different director in mind the entire time, but I'll save it. I think the intro works. I'm with Matt a lot of the time, but it feels kind of fitting for this piece. A couple reasons. One, we get to keep that 95 minutes. Thank you, 80s action movies. Whew, short and sweet. I know Jeff Loeb wrote Commando, and he might as well have written this too, because that guy, as he likes to say, he writes comic books so short you can read them while you're peeing. You are running from the beginning to the end of this film. And I think that, look, the beginning, it sets you in the world. You know what's going on. It does its job perfectly fine. And like a lot of the sci-fi, it's weird. This isn't sci-fi, but it feels like it. It's kind of in that realm. And it's sometimes you just get that. You feel like you're looking at a computer screen with data letting you know what's going on and dumping you into the world. So as much as usually I'm right there and I agree with Matt, I think I agree with him here too. Like, it fits this piece.
One thing I want to mention, I said that Arnold was kind of disappointed it didn't adhere more to the story. You know who else really hates this movie, unsurprisingly?
Richard Dawson?
King himself.
No.
Yeah.
Of course he hates a good, well, I'll say, of course he hates his good ones. His entertaining ones.
A lot of the reasons he gave.
He hates adaptations that have the blank man in them.
He really knocked the casting of Arnold Schwarzenegger, much like he knocked the casting of Jack Nicholson in this, because you know from the beginning that Arnold is going to win everything because of how big of a presence he is.
Stephen King would be the guy who watches WrestleMania and roots for Andre the Giant to beat Hulk Hogan.
Like, nobody was able to throw him out of the Royal Rumble.
Like King, do you realize that you tried the thing of trying to use a different name to sell your product? Getting the who was about to be and was on the cusp of being the biggest movie star in the world to sell one of your properties, and you're going to bitch about it?
He hated how the aesthetic was, the whole, and we'll talk about it, but this pretty much satirizes 80s game shows more than it actually tells a story of a guy fighting for his life.
Satirizes 80s culture in general.
Yeah.
But also, Arnold was a little upset with how it was directed. He listened to interviews. He talked about how it felt too much like a TV show, which Arnold, you're kind of missing the point.
Well, speaking of Arnold, we see him in the air moving in on a food riot. He doesn't see any weapons, but his superiors tell him to fire. But Ben resists and fights back against the helicopter. And by the way, this footage of these helicopters in the air, I didn't think I'd mention this name in this podcast, but here we go, because Dino De Laurentiis had nothing to do with this. But this footage of these helicopters is from Dino De Laurentiis' 1976 King Kong movie. So Just kind of took and redid that footage.
Well, we also have to address the funniest thing right off the bat is you have this Austrian, you know, bodybuilder
named Ben.
Ben Richards.
Yes.
Who, that's the most Americanized, like, generic guy name there is. And you give it to this guy?
I know. Of all things to not change, why not change that? Because honestly, with the exception of that name, this movie has little to no similarities to that book, which I think is why King was so against it, quite honestly. We get a struggle in the helicopter as Richard hangs out of it, and he's told that he's going to fry for what he's done, and then he gets knocked out. We see bodies getting hauled off as we're in some sort of steel plant. We have Ben carrying this huge steel pillar because we have to have Arnold carrying something huge on his shoulder, much like Commando the year before, a couple years
ago. And he's also the only guy in this prison who could realistically do it.
Yes.
I mean, we leave this helicopter and suddenly I'm like, hang on, my movie just skipped a Total Recall, because I feel like this is exactly the job he has at the beginning of that too.
Yes. And we're seeing dudes getting led through a field. Ben starts punching guards and we have a full-on riot. Guards are getting punched and Ben gives one a lift, as he says. Man, the zingers in this come at you fast and furious. This is...
Did you just say that because Rob Cohen produced
this? Yes, I did.
You bitch.
I mean, come on, these zingers. One is ridiculous and stupid. I get why you would keep a lot of these, but goddamn. Matt, even you as the Arnold fan, there's way too many of these, right?
No, because this is not Batman and Robin.
It feels like it, though.
No, just because he makes an ice pun in this movie 10 yeah. years before that, but it doesn't bother me in this. This movie does not do a lot of pretense about hiding the fact that it's an Arnold vehicle, and that comes with the territory. It doesn't feel as out of place, and we'll revisit this eventually, maybe very soon, actually. It doesn't feel as out of place as, like, the opening of Predator, when they tear up that village and he's saying, like, you know, stick around or knock, knock. It's not like that, because the rest of the movie feels like contrast. Here, this whole movie is exaggerated, as we'll come to see. So I don't hate how he is playing up to his image.
Not only do I like it, but I freaking love it. Just because I think it fits the tone of what we have. This movie is colorful, shiny candy. This is the new nerd clusters. It's like, hey, you know, you liked nerds, right? Hey, you liked gummy shit, right? We're putting it all together and shoving it in your mouth for a diabetic overdose. And that's kind of what this movie is. And it lets you know that from the beginning. I think because of the game show aesthetic and feel. And getting Richard Dawson, even though we don't see him yet. Because that type of family feud interaction lends itself to these type of jokes on that show, and it just doesn't feel as out of place as, yeah, the beginning of Predator or so many other films. But I will say that this is like his makeup person got less work than his one-line writers in the course of this film.
Oh, the beard that's held on by duct tape?
Yes. Terrible beard. It's so bad. We see Arnold get cozy up to Yaphet Kotto, who I completely forgot was in this movie.
And is the only person in this movie who is, like, as tall as Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
So, of course, if there's someone who can withstand a punch from him, it would be Yaphet Kotto.
Third time that we've discussed Yaphet Kotto together.
So Richards is asking for the deadline to be shut off as the perimeter is deactivated, and we see a guy get his head completely blown off. And I thought we just finished Kingsman. Why are we talking about people's heads being blown off?
Oh, with the Suicide Squad bombs?
Yes.
Damn it. But they look like the collars from Wild Wild West.
Never saw that movie, actually.
Don't.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
Watch the Kenneth Branagh scenes.
At this time, the MPAA was all over shit like this, and this had to be cut a bit. They had more heads being blown off, and they had to cut all of them out because the MPAA was just... Look, Temple of Doom was a few years before. They were like, we're not going to let too much of this shit go by, but they let this one go by. And I think it's fun. I always like seeing a good head explosion effect.
But it's funny, like you mentioned Paul Verhoeven, and obviously he would work with Schwarzenegger Total Recall, but this movie, unlike RoboCop, does not have the blood squibs. This one's considerably more tame. If you get queasy about that kind of stuff, this one's nowhere near as over the top as that. And like nobody gets hit by a car and just explodes on the windshield.
It does cut itself at times, even the head explosion. You know exactly what happened, but yeah, RoboCop would show it. Verhoeven would show it. This is surprisingly tame for all that it does get away with.
And look, if you're comparing this to 80s television, you didn't see that kind of violence on network television. Everything was still very playing that close to the chest. as far as what you would see on TV. So maybe that is intentional. And it's not until you get into the arena that you actually start to see more viscera.
Don't forget, too, that Paul Verhoeven's first choice for RoboCop was Arnold. So I think they did have kind of a relationship at this time.
Well, Schwarzenegger wanted Verhoeven to do Total Recall. Like, he contacted said, I want to do this movie. Because could you imagine Cronenberg working with Schwarzenegger?
Oh, my God. We then cut to the show, The Running Man, being hosted by Killian, Richard Dawson himself. And I'm going to say this right now, boys. The best part of this movie is Richard Dawson. I love him in this. What's so funny is people who worked on Family Feud said the Richard Dawson you see in this is more like the real person than what you saw on Family Feud. I guess he just ruled with an iron fist, was a total dick behind the scenes on that show. But he is great in this.
He's amazing. Like, I know the other people that they looked at for it, but he fits this so well. And he was on TV. I don't know, whatever the male equivalent was for America's Sweetheart. But he's like Bob Barger. He was that familial presence that you invited into your home every night, and families would gather around the TV and watch.
Essentially assault your mother.
And so to have him here, he's obviously playing himself amped up, which is, I guess, kind of like what Arnold always does. So they're the perfect 1-2 combination. If this doesn't work, the movie really suffers, and he works well.
You're right. Every good movie has a good villain. And he turns on the ham, but he's also just, you just tell he's just a total dick. It's just amazing the way he plays this.
He's on the Mount Rushmore of 80s action villains, if you ask me. I think this is on par with stuff like Hans Gruber.
Wow.
As far as memorability, as far as quotable lines, as far as elevating the movie, because in a lot of ways, he has the showier role compared to Schwarzenegger. Certainly gets more dialogue. Maybe even has more screen time. I mean, it's pretty close. It's one of the few instances where you getting a non-actor in your movie actually works better because he understands improv. Part of being a game show host is you are playing up to the crowds, oftentimes with contestants who have no clue how to be interesting on TV. So he's working with people who are, I mean, look, Schwarzenegger is no thespian. Neither is Jesse Ventura, for that matter. He's having to do a lot of what draws you in, and you just hate him. He's playing up sort of the archetype or the opposite of what he presented himself as on Family Feud. And apparently, like you guys said, this is a lot closer to the real life person, apparently. But I think he is terrific. And I don't think this movie would be as well regarded if it wasn't for him, or you just cast like a, because I could see an alternate version of the script where you cast like a well-known comedian.
Oh, yeah.
To play this role, like a Steve Martin, a Martin Short, even a Robin Williams in this type of role, because they're also very theatrical and animated. But getting someone who did this on television in this hyper-realistic world is a great bit of casting. And he is also on the Mount Rushmore of game show hosts. It's like him, Bob Barker, Alex Trebek, and pick your fourth.
We're hearing that the show's being run 24 hours a day, and Killian says that The Truth hasn't been very popular lately. These ratings haven't fallen, but they've tapered off, so they need something to kind of spring these ratings up. Ben's real motives are being questioned, as he's told that it's nothing worth losing your head over, and he then just lights a cigar.
With what's-his-name from Fleetwood Mac?
Yeah, Mick Fleetwood. I didn't even discuss him. Mick Fleetwood. So we have Mick Fleetwood and Dweezil Zappa playing Stevie, guys. Stevie, this is bizarre. He's not in it too much. We have him in old age makeup here. What was up with this?
I don't know why he was cast. I genuinely don't, because it's not like, he didn't go the David Bowie route of making, multiple movies and really pursuing that as a career. I want to know how he got in this, because the only other thing I could think of was he was a guest on Star Trek TNG in an episode of that, but it's not like he made a ton of movies, so I guess because Fleetwood Mac was kind of, I don't want to call it rebellious, but it wasn't a lot of conventional music. And there was as much fighting in that band as there was in the arena.
I was like, hey, that's great. Like, I like seeing him in it. He's perfectly fine. I'll say for my entire life, I've been told that I need to care about the Zappa family, and I've never given two shits about them, Frank or Dweezil. But I like seeing Mick Fleetwood here. It's kind
of
cool.
Don't forget, we discussed one of the Zappas when we did Children of the Corn last year.
I'm still resentful.
It's funny to cast him in this movie because he's wearing that black leather cap that makes him look like Angus Young from AC/DC.
Good point. Guys, I've been doing this show with you guys for a while now, and very rarely have I had to pause a movie because I was laughing so hard. I don't think I have laughed so hard as when we see Arnold saying he's not into politics as he walks away from the resistance.
caught that. That popped me pretty big.
Uh-huh.
And when it's not only he that's in it, but you have two governors
yes.
together in this film.
It's, where does he get arrested? Bakersfield, California. Where yes. did he get governor?
Oh, my God. Oh, like I said, how prophetic was this fucking movie?
Like, this movie is so prophetic, it might as well be in the Bible as, as part of Genesis.
So Killian pulls up to the show, and he just comes off as just a complete asshole. We then see Amber, played by Maria Conchita Alonso, who will be in Predator 2 a few years from this, but here she's working alongside Arnold. She's working out to ads featuring Captain Freedom and his aerobic workout. Yes, I said that sentence. Guys, it cannot be overstated how big aerobics were in the 80s, and they're kind of playing up to this, although, of all people, I would not expect Jesse the Body fucking Ventura to be hosting an aerobics instruction, but here well, we are.
Of course, a guy nicknamed The Body would be doing exercise videos
yes.
after his heyday, but this was also past the time, and this is kind of meta in a way. He was no longer wrestling, and it's kind of a mm-hmm. commentary on what these guys did after they left the ring. They got into entertainment, they got into announcing, a lot of them, which he himself did around this time. Yep. So I think this is actually him, I don't want to say coming to terms with where he was in his post-wrestling career, but he's having fun with it. I mean, he's not, unlike Dwayne Johnson, he doesn't take himself very seriously.
She's talking to her coffee maker as she's approached by Ben, who's also on the news. He asks if she's a friend of his brother's as she's in his apartment, and Ben says that he's innocent, and my God, this scene is so fucking uncomfortable.
Yeah, this is like when Roger Moore goes after yeah. Maude Adams and Man with the Golden Gun. It's that level of uncomfortable.
It's not my fault. I thought she was the maid.
Yeah, I thought of that too. So yeah, but
this is, I mean, look, Total Recall proved that he has no problem leaving his blonde wife for a Hispanic maid. That was also very prophetic.
Yes.
This movie takes itself not seriously, which I love, and I think that's needed, and it's got a lot of lightheartedness. But some of this, and especially here with her, has some pretty fucking dark moments. And I'm sure that's the book stuff coming through, but yeah, there's parts where you're like, oof, that's dark.
We see Kurt Fuller going over contestants a few years before he tried talking Hulk Hogan down and his new competitor named Zeus. Here we're seeing him show Killian Ben Richards, and Killian takes a liking to him.
This dude always, I don't know what it is. It's probably because of No Holds Barred. This dude's a greasy skid mark. It is hard to watch him on yes. screen. Something just really creeps me out in anything he does.
Killian says he needs Richards as his biceps alone will get him ratings.
I mean, that was Vince McMahon's metaphor.
Definitely.
You were built with
orange pythons, brother.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's partially why he picked Warrior.
Mm-hmm.
Because the unbelievable physique.
We see Amber tied up in a very interesting way. As Ben goes through her things, including black market clothing. He asks Amber to come with him by lifting her exercise equipment and saying please. We didn't see Arnold in an interesting Hawaiian disguise as she gives him attitude. And this was a few years before Arnold breaks the glass in Total Recall screening system. But yeah. they're allowed to pass.
Well, it's also like Commando where he's walking through the yeah. airport.
We're in the same outfit he does in Twins with Danny DeVito.
Oh my God. Everything here. Amber makes a run for it saying who Richards is as he's run down and captured. He's brought before Killian, and there...
You missed... I know you don't like the one-liners, but that scene has the best line in this movie because it's an actual joke that was written. But she talks about throwing up, and he goes, you won't see it on this shirt or something like that. Because Hawaiian shirts are designed to be hideous.
Yes. Ben's brought before Killian, and they call each other the asshole they saw on TV. Killian says that he pulled some strings to get him there and asked him to appear on The Running Man, and Arnold replies with, fuck you. Which, every time I hear Arnold say fuck you, I can't help but laugh.
Well, he says that as much as bullshit. Those were
yes.
those in like every other movie.
Killian says if he resists, his friends are going to go in his place. So they pipe some sort of gas in to knock him out. Meanwhile, Amber starts putting together that Ben is actually innocent, and they're cut to another Running Man game. Climbing for dollars. And by the way, this whole home version of the Running Man, greatest joke I have seen in the whole movie.
And that it keeps coming back.
Yeah. Oh,
the greatest.
So great.
Like, it's one of the great running gags in a movie of mm-hmm. how they just keep using that. And did they ever sell that as a merchandising item?
I don't think so. I don't remember
it. They missed out on a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, don't forget, this was an R-rated film, too. I don't think they would start doing that until Terminator 2.
Yeah, but you had, like, if they sold Nukem from RoboCop.
Yeah, you're right. So Ben's told it's time, and we cut to another icon from the 80s and 90s, Paula Abdul, as she has choreographed this dance sequence. Yes, Paula Abdul, she of Forever Your Girl, straight up choreographed this dance number.
It really is amazing when you look at the people that are associated with this movie in any capacity. This is the fucking Avengers of the 80s.
Yes.
It's fantastic to bring in some of her own Laker girls to do it. And it helps it because it gives it that feel. This actually chews up some time because this is a short movie, but we get two fairly lengthy dance sequences throughout the course of this thing.
I think that's also satirical because TV was syndicated and you had to fill the time somehow. So yeah, I was like, all right, just put hot women out there to appease people. Because this is very much, not only are they satirizing 80s TV, this is their futuristic version of Gladiators.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And realize, at this time, sports wasn't what it is now. Basketball was an almost non-entity unless you were watching the Chicago Bulls. Football was one day a week and got okay ratings. Baseball, you went to in person. So it was game shows and TV.
And reality TV was not a thing.
No. Thank God. That would come years after this.
You know, we got to mention that. This really foretold not just how reality TV was structured, but audiences' obsession over certain people on those shows, where they rooted for them like you would root for Joe Montana. Sort of that, because that crossbreeding of reality TV, sports, social commentary, everything they do with The Running Man, you will see evolve into modern entertainment. Because this is, I think of stuff like The Bachelor or even things like Survivor. It was about the people that were on it as much as the concept.
What's funny about this is, I want to go back to the book for a second. In that book, it's not so contained in this arena type atmosphere. It's a show taking place outside in the streets. So the Ben Richards character, he's going from New York to Boston, and anybody who sees him, if they let the show know and it is proven that they are right, they get money for it. So there are bounties on him no matter where he goes. And of course, he eventually ends up in Derry, Maine. Of course he does. But here, by keeping it so contained, you have changed it for an 80s audience, and I think that was a welcome change. I think the way the book is structured in the show aspect is a little too 50s and 60s. That's the way game shows were back then. Matt, it was good to update it like this, right?
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Escape from New York with how like part of it is walled off. It's not a prison, but this is not New York, or it's not LA as you would imagine it. But I also love how it's got the theatricality of something like Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Came out a little bit before this. And society's kind of in a similar state where things are under some kind of totalitarian rule, and what gives the people hope or enjoyment is the questionable entertainment that is presented.
Oh, yeah. I think if this was on today, people would watch it and watch it in spades.
I mean, look what we keep trying to do. We keep trying to redo American Gladiators.
Mm-hmm.
The Rock did his Titan Games, which popped big for one season, stopped showing up, and
then the XFL. Yeah.
But yeah, this is the type of shit people want to keep seeing.
Amber's told that she's lucky to be alive as Ben walks by and looks at her, and then her friend says that she's lucky he didn't rape and kill her. Killian takes the mic and says it's showtime as he brags about Running Man being the number one show in the world. Ben signs some papers before pinning it right on this poor schlub's back, and Killian gets a kiss from an audience member, which of course Dawson did a lot of. When he had a family on, if you were a child, if you were an old woman, he would kiss you right on the fucking lips. And Ben is introduced to the audience under doctored footage of him taking out the demonstrators, and he's given the nickname the Butcher of Bakersfield. Boys, deepfake before deepfake was a thing.
Oh yeah, this movie was prophetic in that way too, and also with how you cannot believe anything that's on the news.
It's insane. We keep saying it, but goddamn, the prophetic nature of this movie in this ridiculous Arnold action science fiction film is just beyond what I have ever seen in the movie we have covered.
Going through this, I was just like, this hit. Oh, this is like this. Oh, this is like this. And I'll finally say it because Matt brought up another film and it made me think of, this is the most John Carpenter film that could have been made that he didn't make. In the tone, what it's about. I know we're going to get to John Carpenter here pretty soon with King, but I could see him doing a version of this film that is much more akin to Escape from New York, They Live, just that type, because it is the exact same sensibilities.
Killian shows footage of past Running Man winners as Ben sees that his friends are in the Running Man as well, and they're sent to an obstacle course where they'll have 3 hours to get through it. Ben tells Killian that he'll be back, and Killian responds with the best response to this line I have ever heard, only in a rerun, as he's sent off in this amazing-looking contraption and ride. God, this was great.
Oh, the underground chute that puts them in the middle of the map. Yeah, this is awesome. Although I want to know how the government built these tunnels.
Right. This was a Paul Michael Glaser idea. They had built this whole set, and it wasn't as dynamic as the set as we see here. So he demanded that they just redo this entire thing. And he was the one who included these shoots, which they show off 3 or 4 times in this movie. And it's great every single time they do.
Especially because you kind of understand what's going on. It feels very video gamey. It's part of what adds to the aesthetic and feel of all of this.
Man, you
it's also far more interesting cinematically than just putting them in a helicopter and throwing them out of a plane.
Mm-hmm.
God, you bring up a good point. Why didn't they make a video game based off this movie?
They did.
They did?
Smash TV.
Oh, yeah. Well, they ripped this movie off, pretty much is what they did.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a ripoff, but it's that type of thing, yeah.
We see Amber digging through some raw footage of what actually happened as she's caught. Bets are being placed on who will win, as one woman picks Sub-Zero because, as she puts it, he's big and cuddly.
All right, well,
favorite woman in this film.
Pathetic for sports gambling.
Yes.
Yeah.
And guys, I had to do a double take. I'm looking at this guy. I'm like, is that Odd Job? No, it's not Odd Job.
No, it's Professor Tanaka.
Yeah.
They have entrances like wrestlers did.
Definitely. Again, I think WWF was a huge influence on this film. Captain Freedom is interrupted as Ben and William are attacked by Sub-Zero. Not the one from Mortal Kombat, mind you, but... different one. He's in some hockey gear, and you know, we've been having a lot of fun with this, but I'm going to go ahead and say I think these action scenes, well, at least this scene kind of sucks. There's bad cutting and choreography going on here.
Any of them, this is the one to criticize, but it does let you know that this is all set up studio-wise because they're being funneled into a place where this is all done. But this is when, though, I have a question with this person, and it gets explained later, but there's no... Okay, the people that are in here, because they have normies, and then he needs a ratings boost, which is why he goes to Arnold, or Ben Richards. He needs that ratings boost. The normal people won't do it. Is there a normal version of this game show? Because you could never beat any of the stalkers. I know we see the people dead later on, but nobody could ever win.
Well, they say 3 people dead.
This is the one instance where I feel like if this movie had a John McTiernan or a Paul Verhoeven at the helm, this would be talked about on the same level as Terminator or the S tier of Schwarzenegger films, because for an action movie, it doesn't have that one iconic, well-shot, well-orchestrated action sequence. They're sporadic throughout, and they're serviceable, but none of them are outstanding.
Maybe Paula Abdul should have choreographed the fight scenes as well.
I mean, but this was prophetic because what was the next thing he would do? He made a hockey movie.
Who did?
Cutting Edge.
Oh, Paul Michael Glaser. Yeah, I thought you meant Arnold. Yeah, you're right.
No, if Arnold made a hockey movie, it would have been something like Slapshot. It would have been a comedy.
Yes. Which I just watched for the first time, by the way. It's amazing.
That movie's so fucking good.
It's great. Ben's knocked out as William is running for his life and he's run down by Sub-Zero. Ben gets back involved as he rescues William and he literally yanks Sub-Zero's throat loose. Of course, he has to cap it off with the worst line of this entire movie. Sub-Zero is now plain Zero. What does that even mean? You're already less than Zero, so now you're better than less than Zero? It makes no sense.
Yeah, you know who should have asked, what does that mean? The screenwriter.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the director with this screams first take only.
Yep.
It's not like Commando where they at the end, if you watch the special features on Commando, they did like 50 takes of him throwing the pipe into Bennett and saying a line. And there was like 50 of them and they picked that one. They should have done something similar here and picked a better one.
This is great. As Killian's mourning the loss of Sub-Zero. And then we cut to a commercial. It's so funny.
The audience, the way that they treat it like they just watched. They responded the way you see like how a school shooting shows up on the news.
Yeah.
Where it's just dead silent. People are looking somber and sulking. And what would a TV do when you're in a panic? You cut the commercial.
Cut to a commercial.
The only thing that's missing is the RoboCop type of ads.
Yeah, that's why I thought Paul Verhoeven would have been perfect for this.
But I also think it would have been, even though this came out the same year, I can still differentiate enough from RoboCop where they feel like 2 different movies. I feel like if Verhoeven did both, there would have been just too many similarities.
Of course, we get another line from Ben here as he says that Sub-Zero was just a real pain in the neck.
I mean, that's straight out of the James Bond code book.
Definitely. Killian explains Gillian's Island as the one with the boat and brings out Buzzsaw and Dynamo. Meanwhile, Amber is brought before Killian as Dynamo makes his grand entrance. Now, this guy, he was an opera singer, And they didn't incorporate this until they realized he was an opera singer. So they had him do this whole thing. I hate to say it. I don't like Dynamo that much. I just think he's too cartoonish for this movie. And I know that's weird to say, but I don't like this character.
Well, it's worth noting he was also a wrestler.
Yeah, he was a wrestler. Right before this thing was released, he died at 34 years old of a heart attack.
But wrestler, opera singer, movie star. I mean, that's quite a resume at just 34. I also love how he's so electric that he literally... I mean, this looks like someone left the grid in Tron and entered this movie, because that's what his wardrobe would be of.
There's always one character you're like, could do without. And I could do without Lightbright. I mean, it's funny for the almost more for the audience than for me at home.
You got Professor Tanaka, you got Jesse Ventura, you got someone we'll talk about in a little bit. Is there a more recognizable person you could have got in this role?
I mean, hell, Vince McMahon had a slew of them. You could have picked any of those. Like, but anyone
off the like, if you got like a big entertainer, because he literally uses electricity, this was like Prince or like a musician.
Good Bowie.
But, you know, and he's also the subject of Arnold's worst lines, because he just calls him light bulb, Christmas tree. And he's just on the other end of a lot of the zingers here. Amber makes her way on the stage as Killian says that she has broken the law her entire life and even cheated on college exams and had sexual relations with two, sometimes three men in a year. You slut.
This is also prophetic in the way that they slut shame her.
But it's also, I mean, look at the news nowadays. It's amazing just how much this is current culture and current Americana. Yeah, this type of degradation of women, because she might have had sex with two or three people in a year.
Yeah.
I mean, damn.
Meanwhile,
there's also the one instance, though, where the writing is not good, because she denies the third. She's like, oh, that's not true, but doesn't deny sleeping with multiple guys or any of the promiscuous stuff they accuse her of. It's the political one that she draws the line at. So that's kind of, remember, we're still in the 80s.
Yeah, now they would really work to defend that image. But you're right. She just lets that stuff slide, which is bizarre.
I mean, if this was Verhoeven directing, she would have been raped at this point. That's where this movie would have gone.
Meanwhile, Ben doesn't want to jam the network. He just wants to move on as Amber is stalked. But she ends up right by Ben as she explains that she was trying to help him, which is why she's there. Buzzsaw and Dynamo, they attack as Ben and William get separated from Amber. They continue to avoid Buzzsaw until he wraps Ben in a cord and drags him behind him. But Ben's able to turn the tables and flip him from his bike. But Buzzsaw gets up and attacks as the nerd tries finding a way to bypass the system. Buzzsaw says that he's going to make his saw a part of him as Ben overpowers him and lifts the saw right between his legs. Meanwhile, Dynamo, he attacks Amber as Ben shows up to rescue her with classical music playing in the background.
Well, yeah, they use Flight of the Valkyries, which Apocalypse Now would kind of make famous. But I also love how one of the hallmarks of Schwarzenegger movies is testicular pain or dismemberment.
Yeah.
Because there's multiple instances in Total Recall where he gets kicked in the dick.
Yep. He chases Ben through the street, but Ben avoids the vehicle until it tumbles off the rocks, and Ben says that he's not going to kill him as he and Amber run, and Ben says that Buzzsaw couldn't join them because he had to split. I say those lines just so I can hear Matt laugh, because I know it makes him do it every time.
I also love how they're all shot the same way, where they're running and he just does ADR over it.
Yep, that's D'Souza, according to him in an interview. William tells Ben to not let him die for nothing, as he doesn't want to be the only asshole in heaven. Killian calls Ben and offers him a 3-year contract, as he knows real talent when he sees him. Ben says he's going to ram his fist into Killian's stomach and then put it out through his spine. This is one of those things where you don't let Arnold say more than 10 words at a time. This was a really weird thing to have him say to Killian here.
I think he says more in that one section than he says in the entirety of
Terminator. Yes. Also in the book, this is when he accepts the offer from Killian to become a stalker. But when he's en route, that's when Killian tells him that his wife and kid are actually dead. So he takes the route that he does. So that's how the book ends. We then get good old Jim Brown. He's here as Fireball. And we see an old lady who says that the next kill will be done by Ben Richards, calling him one mean motherfucker. And the bets start pouring in.
Although I thought foul language was against the, maybe because I'm thinking of 1984, but probably she said that on TV and nobody had her arrested or beat out. But I also love how Jim Brown, you see him a couple times watching the movie, and then you hear, Fireball, please report to wardrobe. So you're like, oh, he's one of the stalkers. Which makes sense that you would get Jim Brown to play a runner.
Yeah, exactly.
And I got to say, this is about the point, maybe about a little more than half of the way, 2/3 of the way in. Family came home from something they were out doing, and I got my daughter curled up next to me on the couch watching the entire second half of this film.
Nice. What'd she think?
Oh, it's funny because it was brought up earlier. She goes, Wait, so this is the Hunger Games?
By the way, of all the people who have not gotten biopics, Jim Brown needs one. When you look at all the shit he did in his life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Come on, Netflix.
Ben hears a noise, and it's not Jesus Christ, as he proclaims, as Fireball approaches and Amber continues to complain. Amber and Ben get separated, and Amber finds some dead bodies, which, of course, were the result of the Running Man game here. Fireball comes in and says that they're last year's losers, as Ben blows him up and proclaims him a hothead.
This is the one plot hole in the movie. Why would the network have TV cameras showing the dead bodies?
Meanwhile, Captain Freedom says that he's not going out there because of the war he was in. Since he refuses, Killian asks if the steroids have made him deaf and tells him to leave. This is the one thing, you know. I know we're going to kind of get a fight between Ventura and Schwarzenegger, but they're building up to that, and we never get it for real. I thought that was kind of a mistake.
I like that as a bit of misdirection. And I also like how his wardrobe is so antiquated compared to everyone else. He looks like one of those cardboard robots you would dress up as for Halloween, and you just paint it silver.
Oh, he looks like Osimo in Cartman. Yes.
Ben and Amber, they get in the control room, and Amber proclaims that she has the uplink code. She's then dropped into the arena, or the crowd thinks she is, as Captain Freedom breaks her neck and throws her into barbed wire. Freedom then pushes fake Ben into spikes with some of the worst ADR I have ever seen in a film. This is really bad. But you know what? The first time you see this, you're kind of faked out.
You're completely faked out the first time you see it. You don't know. You're caught unawares. So it's a good little swerve that way. It is ridiculous to watch this now. It is crazy to look at this now and realize, I mean, this movie's 40 years old, just about at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And this is AI video to fool the masses put on by a media company. This shit is, I mean, we're having fun and this is haha, good time, Arnold one-liner fun. This is, and this is why I mentioned I thought a Carpenter for it. This is that type of watch the dark road that society walks down, because we're kind of here. Like, we're staring this movie in the face.
Oh, we busted that door down like the Kool-Aid Man.
Yeah.
But this also works because the movie, while it is futuristic, you don't know what the technological capabilities are.
Yeah.
So this doesn't feel out of place. And I also like that it's not foreshadowed or teased. So that adds to that believability, especially because outside of Terminator, you never saw Schwarzenegger get beat up or killed.
Amber says that she's happy because now they can go wherever they want, but Ben responds that they'll never let them out of here alive.
Yeah, he pulled his inner Hulk Hogan and said, that doesn't look from each other.
That's not in a Hulk Hogan voice. What was that?
Arnold.
Oh, okay. Ben then proclaims that he wants a piece of Killian because he promised him he'd be back and he didn't want to disappoint him. Amber reveals that she has the actual broadcast of Ben's arrest and then tells him it's none of his business where she hid it. She then tells Ben good luck as Killian is revealed to have been killing past winners and Ben's real video is shown. Killian says that they're experiencing technical difficulties as Ben storms in and says showtime.
I hate this cliche in movies of broadcasting the villain's plan to the masses, but it kind of works in this movie because it's all about media manipulation.
Definitely. Yeah, and this was way before that became a cliche.
Yeah, which is why I don't rebel against it, because this movie has two tropes that I hate. Opening expository text crawl and a liar revealed to the masses. So I like this, and I also like how to incorporate a wrestling term. This is a double turn for the masses. Mm-hmm. Arnold has become the full babyface, and this is the it's me, Austin.
Final boss has showed up here at the end. It's great that way. And yeah, I usually agree the same way about suddenly you got cameras and tapes and audio showing the villain's main reveal. But with it being a media network, it's perfectly in line with what you would have. Though, hey, delete your backups. There's no reason to keep that original file of Ben Richards not shooting.
Yeah. So,
come on. If Hillary taught you all anything, wipe your hard drives. I gotta say, though, this ending, I get disappointed when it turns into everybody shows up with guns and it's a random shoot-em-up for the last 10 minutes. Because I feel like it just devolved here a little bit at the end until we get a couple more great one-liners. But having Mick Fleetwood show back up with pretty much Dennis Leary's crew from Demolition Man and everybody running in with AK-47s, this isn't what this movie's been up to this point.
That's a good point. This is a disappointing final act. And the way to resolve this is not to have Ben Richards be the one you revolve your resistance around. That just doesn't work, especially since he hasn't really done anything except be proven that he's innocent. That's it.
Yeah.
The battle is on as Dynamo goes after Amber. Wasn't expecting this pairing. Chaos ensues as the audience runs out and Dynamo is killed with Tron/Palpatine effects. More gunfire ensues as Ben finally approaches Killian, but this is interrupted by Sven. He walks up and says that he got to score some steroids and walks off.
To me, this shot between Dawson, Sven, and everything else, and especially with all the wrestlers, with all the inside knowledge, this felt like the bullshit going on with Vince, his wrestlers, and the government. It probably wasn't, maybe a little too soon. There's no reason to shove those lines in there. It just felt like maybe Ventura was just twisting the knife a little bit.
Yeah, this was about 7 years out from that, but that doctor was still hanging out in the locker rooms around this time, so...
Mm-hmm.
He tries talking some sense into Ben as he says that all he's doing is giving the people what they want. Ben says that he's a quick learner and that he's going to give the audience what they want as he straps Killian in and sends him off, and Killian crashes into a billboard of the soda he's been hawking this entire movie, which I thought was brilliant.
Yeah, because you see that billboard three times.
Yeah.
Yep.
But also he dropped dead. I don't do requests.
Mm-hmm. When this is over, Ben says that hit the spot. The crowd starts chanting Richard as Amber walks up to him, and Ben approaches her, pulls her close, and kisses her to a huge ovation. Now, originally, the ending of this was going to be kind of similar to what I outlined in the beginning, in that he was going to crash into, if not a skyscraper, then a building that had this whole network inside of it. But the director was like, you know what? I want to close out on a happy note, so let's just put these two with zero chemistry together at the end and have them kiss. Makes no sense.
It's also, we have to slap in a cheesy 80s pop song, love ballad.
God, this is a terrible song.
Movie. I don't have a lot of complaints about this movie, but that's a big fucking one.
Oh, it's terrible.
I mean, like the song, but it is a weird way to end this film.
You don't like this song. You don't.
I like this cheesy 80s crap. I fucking do.
Out of my life.
Are you kidding? You know how many times I got to go over sweater, you know, to the cutting edge listening to this kind of music.
We cut to outside the building as credits roll. There we have it. The Running Man. One of the more animated discussions of the past weeks, I gotta say. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we give The Running Man? Adam?
Terminator, Predator, Conan. The Running Man? I can't say you put this on the Mount Rushmore, maybe with other Arnold films, but I do think this is as iconic because of, Matt brought it up during it, the look. He's got one look in this. He's in that ridiculous golden unitard throughout this film. This film, when you think of Arnold in the 80s, this comes to mind. And I think because of the one-liners, the over-the-top action, the silliness, playfulness, and self-awareness that this film has lends to its rewatchability and enjoyment when I'm watching it. You could look at this and say that this is as bad as any horribly done, cheesy 80s film. But I think by putting in Richard Dawson to be opposite Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it's amazing that they ended up being friends, that you cast this with wrestlers that we would have seen on Saturday night on pay-per-view, not really pay-per-views at that point, but Saturday night's main event and wrestling superstars and so many things. You populated this film with actors and actresses that you had good feelings towards. And then you have a story that feels pretty relatable of somebody just wanting to get out and do good. You got the media manipulation. There's just so much about this that is rewatchable. It's craveable. It is a deep dish, fatty, oily pizza. It is not the best thing for you, but goddamn, it is enjoyable when you eat it. And that's how I feel about this film. It's hard to talk about this film without smiling about it, without quoting it, without slipping into Arnold impersonations. And yeah, I look forward to seeing what they do remaking it, but I kind of fucking love this film. I know it's not great cinema, but it is a damn good time. I almost wish that I'd watched this at a movie theater as a kid, but I was too young for that. But I was glad when we got to this point because I knew I was at least going to have fun for 90 minutes. I had fun 90 minutes while I watched it. I had another great 90 minutes just discussing this film. I'm going to be realistic, though. I'm going to give it a 7 just because I see some problems with it. There's some, it's not the biggest budgeted film. You got some things you could have definitely done to improve it. But this thing is so much fucking fun. If you like Arnold at all, if you like the sci-fi social commentary shit at all, you got to watch this film. So 7 out of 10 for The Running Man.
7 out of 10 from my best friend. And speaking of liking Arnold, I can't think of a bigger fan of Arnold than our third on this podcast. Matt, what do you give The Running Man, sir?
I don't go to the 80s for reality. I'm sorry. This is my favorite decade of movies, and I've been very lavishing in praise for a lot of the ones we've done. Lethal Weapon, Aliens, Road Warrior. This is not on that tier because it doesn't have the authorial stamp on it of like a Shane Black script or a George Miller or James Cameron at the helm. I do think, though, if you had one of those people on this movie, I would put this on the Mount Rushmore. Three of those that Adam mentioned, I would certainly include. I like Total Recall more than I like this just because of the Verhoeven flourishes. But this is the best Five Guys cheeseburger you'll have in Schwarzenegger's filmography, where it's on the cusp, but it's just not quite. It's missing that big component. But goddamn, it's a hell of a time. If you're a fan of Schwarzenegger for the cheese, the one-liners, the unstoppable, damn near invulnerable superhero, because he doesn't take a whole lot of punishment in this movie, it's hard to be dissatisfied. And the Richard Dawson factor, I can't say enough good things about how great he is. This is one of the great movie villains of that decade. Especially in this genre. I'm going to give it an 8 just because I enjoy myself immensely. But to Adam's point, you know, I can't have too many viewings. Otherwise, I'll wind up in the hospital.
An 8 for The Running Man. Was not expecting that. I guess I got to be this guy then. I got to this one very late. I didn't watch it until I had even heard it was a Stephen King property. Honestly, I thought the sets looked garish in the stills that I saw, and of anything, this was not something that I was rushing out to rent or watch on cable, even though it was on cable a lot when me and Adam were growing up. When I finally got to it, I realized something. Arnold, look, I'm not a big fan of Commando. I'm not a big fan of Raw Deal. I think when he goes raw and gritty, I don't think he's as fun. When he goes into science fiction, though, I think that's where he excels. And this is definitely a science fiction slash adventure film slash comedy, if you count the quips going on here. Like I mentioned, I think the real highlight of this is Richard Dawson. And I didn't realize how big of a highlight he was until I watched it for this podcast. I watched this movie twice for this. You can take any one of his quotes, any one of his deliveries, and if you recycle them and you put them in any movie, it would make that movie that much better. I think this movie, it moves at a clip, but I do feel like the action scenes are lacking, and if you have a science fiction action film, the action needs to work. I think Paul Michael Glazer, for what he was hired to do, did a fine job, but I think once we get to a lot of these fight scenes, as I mentioned, I think they're lacking a lot in excitement, and one of you guys mentioned, but I think Arnold is never in real big danger here, and maybe that's just the Stephen King fan of me coming out, because I mentioned that that's what his big problem with this, but I'm not going to say Arnold was miscast, because look, he is swinging with these zingers, and this is what people go to Arnold movies to see. However, this was not a huge hit. It made $38 million, and I think there's a reason for that. I don't think the buzz on this was as good as, say, Predator or any of his other big science fiction films that were come out. Still, it is a fun time. I'm not going to say it's not a fun time. I don't want to be the grouse here. I was smiling, and that's all you can really ask for when you turn on an Arnold film, and I didn't come here for the depressing nature of that King novel. I came here to have a good time, and this movie is a good time. I will go with a 6. Because of the good time, but don't come to this expecting a Stephen King film. Don't come to this even expecting something that's going to live in your head. Although, as we have mentioned, there are so many things about this that living in 2025, man, you would not have seen what they did in 1987 come as true as it does here in 2025. So many things to really look at and scratch your head at after the fact. But as it's going on, yeah, it's a fun time. 6 out of 10 for The Running Man. All right, guys, we have touched on this, but I want to get into it right now. We are recording this 6 months from the release of Edgar Wright's remake of The Running Man, or Edgar Wright's adaptation of the novel The Running Man. I'm still not sure what we're exactly going to get. My feeling, without seeing a lick of footage, is if you hire Edgar Wright, you are hiring him to remake this movie. I think we're going to kind of get something that's kind of split down the middle. I think we're going to get something with Glenn Powell cast. We're going to get more of that everyman. And I think that we'll have some aspects of this movie that will be mixed in with a lot of aspects of that original King novel, which was published in 1982. Matt, I know we already went over this, but what are you expecting in 6 months when Edgar Wright's The Running Man comes out and we review it?
I honestly don't know. A, we haven't seen much footage, although what they showed at CinemaCon apparently got very strong word of mouth. As far as what I want to see, I hope this is something where when you get Edgar Wright, you actually let him be himself, because look, he got further in this than he did with Ant-Man. This movie at least got shot, but I think he's a great creative mind. I think he's a great filmmaker. And I've seen him actually improve on source material with what he did with Scott Pilgrim. I actually like that movie considerably more than I did the graphic novel series. But having said that, I know it's when you say, oh, we're going to be closer to the Stephen King property, you get stuff like the TV version of The Shining, which I notoriously derided. I hope it's good. I'm optimistic. I like the cast a lot. I have confidence in Edgar Wright. I just don't know exactly, stylistically, what is this movie going to be? is it going to be a straight adaptation of the book, or is it going to be more of a remake of the movie? I don't want this to be like the RoboCop remake or the Total Recall remake, where in a lot of ways they do their own thing, but you get the sense that the studio head said you got to put in references and direct quotes that kind of distract. I hope that's not the case.
Yeah, I hope it finds a way to remember the fun that this film has. I'm not sure how much of the fun is in the book, but I think you need to really play up the game show aspect of it to balance that, especially when you're telling this kind of story. I don't want it to be heavy-handed. I think you could retell the story today and it really just come across like a sermon. I think Edgar Wright's a little smarter than that, so I hope that stays out of it, but I hope it tells a message in a fun way and a dangerous one at that. I hope it plays both sides, but I do think by casting Glenn Powell, they're hoping to get closer that everyman feel. But we also don't have action stars like Arnold anymore. I don't know, I guess you could put The Rock in this film and that's the closest thing that you'd get, you know, but everybody's fucking 60 that's an action star anymore. So I want this film remade. I think it does deserve it. I think it could be good, and I do think Edgar Wright is an inspired choice to bring it to screen. And like Matt, I love the cast, and from what I hear about the source material, there's some really good stuff that could be done, and I hope that's what they end up with. I hope it surprises everybody, and I'm thinking the schedule shows that maybe it's a more thoughtful film than just a popcorn action film.
All right, that's what we're going to expect. And yes, when that movie comes out, the three of us are going to get together and we are going to review that, hopefully week of release. But as we all know, when it comes to new releases, it's tough for us to organize getting that exact week down. But speaking of new releases, that would lead me to what we're going to be doing next. All right, we're going to put Stephen King on the back burner, at least until the Running Man remake comes out. But to take up the next few weeks, actually, I should say next month plus, almost two months. Holy shit. We're going to be taking on a property that me and Matt have attacked before. We have reviewed all of these films before, with the exception of the last two that have come out. Back in 2018, Matt and I brought somebody from the old place on, and we talked about Mission Impossible, and I think those were very good discussions, and we actually tried getting that person on to discuss the one that came out a couple years ago, but unfortunately, our schedules, once again, could not work out. But you know what? I'll go ahead and say I think it's for the better, because I think having Adam on for these next couple months to discuss Mission Impossible is going to be a positive for this series, because I think there are more things to discuss with that series than what we got into. So yeah, we'll be discussing Mission Impossible, starting from the 1996 original, going all the way up to the new one, which will be coming out around the time this podcast is released, I think. But still, we are leading up to that. Matt, what are you expecting when we get to Mission Impossible next week?
I'm kind of happy we're going back to it, because it's been 7 years since we did that series. And I think a lot has happened, obviously, with us doing considerable more podcasting together than we did by the time 2018 rolled around. And I've had, I don't want to say my tastes have changed, but I think there's more that I think can be said. And I think we, obviously the three of us, have a different dynamic than we did back at the old place. So I think it'll make for a justifiable revisit.
All right. Now, Adam, the three of us did discuss Top Gun with Tom Cruise, but we haven't really gone back to Tom Cruise since. What are you expecting when we get to Mission Impossible starting next week?
Thinking that Matt really finds good ways to slide some of his De Palma into a... I love it. Absolutely love it. It made me think of it. I'm like, we're starting off another retro with De Palma. Mm-hmm. I can't believe that I've been watching this series for 30 years. That blows my mind. I can't think of something else where I'm like, yeah, I saw this film in movie theaters 30 years ago, other than maybe like Star Wars. And I didn't see the first one, but to say, yeah, I'm watching the beginning and the end of a series all in theaters and I get to discuss it. I'm pretty excited. Like, I'm not going to lie. I think there's going to be some arguments. In fact, I can guarantee some of these films are going to cause some arguments. I promise that. But I think this is... We're not going to just talk about how we changed with it. I think we get to talk about how the series changed. I think we get to talk about how an actor has changed, how the industry kind of changed around with it. I think it's going to be pretty damn fascinating beyond just the films itself, which each and every film, I think, is going to be a lively discussion. I didn't think about it until I started getting into it. I can't wait.
Yeah, I can't wait either. As Matt mentioned, I think given that we did that series 7 years ago, some aspects of our tastes have changed and some aspects of that actor have changed. And there are things to really, really dive into once we get into each and every film, which is pretty much its own thing. That series, you can argue each and every one of those films are individual films, and it's not until the third and fourth one that they start really mending the Mission Impossible universe together. So definitely things to discuss there. And as Adam said, we're going to discuss De Palma next week, and it's going to be exciting. I can't wait to get into Mission Impossible, and honestly, I can't wait for that new one to come out, and we get to close that out with a new release that's going to close out the series. So until next week, when we get to Mission Impossible, what happened to Buzzsaw? He had the podcast. Thank you, boys.
Listen, they love game shows. They love wrestling. They love sports, violence. So what do? We give them what they want.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Well, that hit the spot.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Here is Sub-Zero! Now, Plain Zero!
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Hey, Christmas tree!
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
Well, first, I've got a little surprise for you.
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advanced look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more.
Well, I haven't been in show business as long as you have, Killian, but I'm a quick learner.
Message us, give us your thoughts, visit and share. We greatly appreciate interacting with you, our listeners.
All I've seen is a bunch of low foreheads who think they can change the world with dreams and talk.
Check out the Percolated Media archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Mad Max movies, the Exorcist films, the movies of the Alien franchise, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
It takes a big man to admit that he needs his friends.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
What a hothead.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
How about the light?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
We're number one, Ben.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Television, that's all it is.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Bastard! Drop dead!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
On ICS Channel 1. Be there! Produced in collaboration with the Zone 4 Department of Justice, All Rights Reserved. The Running Man, America's favorite game show.
You remember the other film he did, right?
Remind me.
Well, the one he did before The Running Man was, oh God, I'm trying to think what it was called. It's got some like multiple word. What the fuck is it called? God damn it. Edit this out. Oh, Band of the Hand.
Yeah.
Is what I was thinking of. You know, that's partially why he picked Warrior.
Because
the unbelievable physique.
Oh, I had the Hulk Hogan workout kit at home when I was a kid.
Yep. God, guys.
What that involves, signing alimony checks?
It was a tape that told me Hulk Hogan's watching you. Don't quit, brother.
I had the same thing. God, guys, if there was a movie made for us.
Bubba the Love Sponge wife.
If there was a movie made for us, it was this, right? I mean, Jesus Christ, for going on so many.
This movie was tailor-made to appease me.
To be reviewed.
I got Schwarzenegger. I got Jesse Ventura. I got
Dawson.
Science fiction. I get wrestlers in this movie. And I get two blaxploitation icons.
We see Amber tied up.
Even though this came out the same year, I can still differentiate enough from RoboCop where they feel like two different movies. I feel like if Verhoeven did both, there would have been just too many similarities.
Mm-hmm. Adam? Adam, are you there?
No, I completely agree.
Okay. Of course.
Come on, if Hillary taught you all anything, wipe your hard drives. Cunts. But this, I gotta say though.
But as we all know, when it comes to new releases, it's tough for us to organize getting that exact week down. But speaking of new releases, that would lead me to what we're going to be doing next. Matt, do you want to talk about this? Because I know this is something you've been wanting to do. Redo, I should say.
You can take it because you're leading the discussions.
Unfortunately. All right. So, what we're going to